Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to update and or introduce a number of different stories. If some of the interpolative and supplemental discussion is somewhat more abbreviated than some listeners might like, and that will probably be the case, then I A, apologize, and B, recommend that people contact Spitfire and get some of the archive shows and or for the record segments that supplement the articles I'm going to be talking about with more complete information taken straight from documentary sources. Without further ado, let's get right to the subject material. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this for us from the Miami Herald of September 27th of 1998. This is an article by Nat Hentoff, and it's headlined, Bill of Rights, Live Them or Lose Them. And this is some advice that I would strongly recommend. This article reads in part, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy warns, quote, the Constitution needs renewal and understanding each generation, or else it's not going to last. This generation, however, as well as its predecessors, is largely ignorant of its rights and liberties under the Bill of Rights and the rest of the Constitution. Monica Lewinsky, for example, has become a household word, but very few Americans know that the President and Congress have greatly damaged the most basic right in the English-speaking world, dating back to the Magna Carta in 1215, the right of habeas corpus. Under this right, anyone convicted in a state court of a capital crime, among other crimes, has the right to petition a federal court to review the trial, was it fair, and the sentence. Until now, over the past 30 years, at least 55 men on death row for 8 or more years have finally been freed through habeas because their innocence has been proved through DNA or other investigative work. But President Bill Clinton has signed into law the Effective Death Penalty Act. It limits to 1 year the time that habeas corpus is available to people facing execution. Therefore, innocent people will be executed. The press has given very little attention to this violation of fundamental rights, nor has much of the press focused on another Clinton law that prevents suspected, quote, terrorists, unquote, vaguely defined, from seeing any of the evidence against them before being deported. Nor are their lawyers allowed to see this evidence. By the way, I would add that some shocking changes in the California Criminal Code were made as a result of the O.J. Simpson case. First of all, a law was passed virtually in secret to allow Nicole's, quote, diaries, unquote. In fact, those were therapy journals that she was keeping at the request of her therapist and included fantasies and dreams. That is a classic example of hearsay evidence and even, frankly, evidence things that aren't evidence, such as dreams or fantasies. A law was passed virtually in secret in California to allow that into evidence for the O.J. Simpson civil case. And beyond that, the blatant forgeries of O.J. Simpson allegedly wearing Bruno Mali shoes, the 30 subsequent forged photos that were used against O.J. Simpson in the civil case, were not examined by O.J.'s defense attorney. Those blatant forgeries included O.J. Simpson allegedly wearing gray Bruno Mali shoes. Bruno Mali has never made a gray shoe, but the judge would not allow O.J. Simpson or O.J. Simpson's attorneys to examine that evidence. According to attorneys of my acquaintance, that particular decision could very easily be used as a precedent and extended into the criminal realm as well, although the O.J. Simpson case, his second trial, was a civil case. So there are terrible abuses of law taking place at the state level as well, and the O.J. Simpson case was one of the worst, although it received no notice. Returning again to this Nat Hentoff column, again from the Miami Herald of September 27, 1998, and researched for us by a listener, repeating that last couple of sentences, the press has given very little attention to this violation of fundamental rights, nor has much of the press focused on another Clinton law that prevents suspected, quote, terrorists, unquote, vaguely defined, from seeing any of the evidence against them before being deported. Nor are their lawyers allowed to see this evidence. But the right that affects us all is the First Amendment. As the late Supreme Court Justice William Brennan once told me, quote, all the other rights flow from the guarantees of free speech, for how else can we change anything, unquote. Yet the House of Representatives has overwhelmingly voted to desecrate the First Amendment by tacking onto it, for the first time in our history, a constitutional amendment punishing the desecration otherwise undefined of the flag. The Senate will soon follow. As Justice Robert Jackson said, speaking for the Supreme Court in a case about children of Jehovah's Witnesses, children who had a First Amendment right not to be coerced into patriotism, who were expelled from public school for not pledging allegiance to the flag, unquote, freedom to differ is not limited to things that do not matter much. That would be a mere shadow of freedom. The test of its substance is the right to differ as to things that touch the heart of the existing order, unquote. Another essential right is the Fourth Amendment's insistence that no person or home can be searched by police without a warrant from a judge who is convinced that there is probable cause for the search, and the warrant must specifically list the persons or materials to be searched. But Clinton supported a move by the House to abolish the core of the Fourth Amendment, the exclusionary rule. This rule states that the products of unconstitutional searches by law enforcement officers cannot be entered as evidence at trial. And if you think that the information I've discussed so far is scary, hang on to your hats and listen to the following. Returning to this Miami Herald article from 9/27/98, Representative Mel Watt, Democrat of North Carolina, was appalled at the obliteration of the Fourth Amendment under this House bill. As proof of the ignorance of the vast majority of the House as to this essential right, Watt ironically offered an addition to the House bill. His addition was the exact wording of the Fourth Amendment. By a huge vote, the House rejected Watt's addition. It rejected the Fourth Amendment. Fortunately, the Senate never got around to considering the removal of the exclusionary rule, so the Fourth Amendment, for now, stands intact. Skipping down, Justice William O. Douglas, a true champion of individual liberties, said, quote, "The Constitution and the Bill of Rights were designed to get government off the backs of the people, all the people, but the guarantee is not self-fulfilling. As nightfall does not come all at once, neither does oppression. In both instances, there is a twilight when everything remains seemingly unchanged, and it is in such twilight that we all must be aware of change in the air, however slight, lest we become unwitting victims of the darkness," unquote. And that quote again from Justice William O. Douglas. It was Representative Mel Watt, Democrat of North Carolina, who introduced the Fourth Amendment as an addition to that House bill. The House rejected it. And again, that column by Nat Hentoff from the Miami Herald, 9/27/98. And a tip of the hat to the listener who researched that for us. Bill Clinton certainly has been a very pliable creature. I do not hold to the demonic theory of Bill Clinton, who I think has been unfairly demonized. Bill Clinton, basically, as a political animal, blows in the wind, no pun intended. And again, I've characterized him in the same terms that von Bismarck characterized Kaiser Wilhelm I. Quote, "He is like a cushion. He always bears the imprint of the last A blank blank that sat on him." And there have been some pretty powerful and sinister A blank blanks sitting on him. And aside from the bullets whizzing around his head and around the White House and the planes carrying him and or his family that have crashed mysteriously and some of the friends of his that have died under strange circumstances, there has been a lot of pressure on Bill Clinton. I do not hold a brief for the man, but I think it's a mistake to see the onset of fascism or the approach of fascism in this country, and that's what's going on, as the product of Bill Clinton, as John Kennedy found out only too clearly, and many other people in less dire fashion since. The President of the United States does not run the country, and he most assuredly, as Kennedy found out, does not call the shots. Even after the impeachment attempt on Clinton failed, and one should note the A blank blanks that have been sitting on Bill Clinton, hence the fact that he retains their impression even after they've gotten up off of him, we are still seeing attempts at smearing Clinton and or pressuring him in the direction that certain powerful A blank blanks would like him to go in, and he certainly has been traveling in that direction. The following is from the Los Angeles Times of Friday, February 26th of 1999. Even as the Monica Lewinsky affair faded into history, more charges of sexual impropriety have surfaced against Bill Clinton, including a woman who claims flat out that Clinton raped her years ago. That story has received a lot of play, but what hasn't received a lot of play are some of the very, very large holes that appear in this woman's story. There was a column by Bill Press, who holds forth on CNN's Crossfire, that was carried in the column left column of the Los Angeles Times of, again, Friday, February 26th of 1999. This column is entitled by the LA Times, "Clinton Rape Charge Can't Be Proved," subtitled, "Juanita Broderick Tells a Familiar Story, but it suffers in the details. And skipping down, we read, Broderick, that's B-R-O-A-D-D-R-I-C-K, sort of an ironic name under the circumstances, Broderick never went to the police. She told NBC's Broderick never went to the police, she told NBC TV's Lisa Myers, because she was sure no one would believe her and because she felt guilty for inviting Clinton to her hotel room. No doubt she's right about that. 20 years ago, rape was rarely reported because too often women were ashamed and, in fact, were held responsible, especially if the rapist were someone she knew. But if Broderick's story sounds familiar, it also sounds fishy and raises too many questions for me to believe her. Broderick says she can remember every detail of the rape, except the month and day it occurred. If it scarred her for life, wouldn't she remember the date, or at least the month? Broderick says she told her husband David what happened, but at the time, David was not her husband. He was her boyfriend with whom she was cheating on her first husband. Question, what if Clinton and Broderick had consensual sex? If you're cheating on your husband and then cheat on your boyfriend, do you tell your boyfriend the truth? Within 1 year of the alleged rape, Broderick attended a fundraiser for Clinton and accepted appointment by him to a state advisory board. Why did she still want to support a man who raped her? Broderick claims Clinton kissed her so hard he left her lip visibly black and blue, and she covered up by telling people she'd had an accident. But her first husband, Gary Hickey, H-I-C-K-E-Y, also an ironic name, says he remembers no such injury when she returned from Little Rock, nor such a story. 1 year later, Broderick filed divorce papers against Hickey, claiming he struck her on the mouth. Was that the only time? Broderick also told two girlfriends who were sisters what happened, which both confirm. But both admit they hate Clinton because he commuted the death sentence of the man who murdered their father. Can they be trusted? And note the following couple of paragraphs. In 1997, Broderick signed an affidavit and gave a deposition in the Jones case denying twice under oath that Clinton raped her. Quote, these allegations are untrue, and there is no truth to these rumors, unquote. If Clinton did rape her 20 years later, why would she still not tell the truth? Last year, Broderick told independent counsel Kenneth W. Starr that her Jones testimony was false, but that she had been under absolutely no pressure from the president or the White House to file a false affidavit. So, did she lie to the Jones team, or did she lie to Starr? Or is she now lying to NBC? How do we know? The truth is, we don't know and will never know, but we do know this. We know that Starr's investigators talked to Broderick and listened to her story and decided not to pursue it. That, in itself, casts huge doubts on Broderick's credibility. If Starr would impeach Clinton for oral sex, he would certainly indict or impeach him for rape, if he could prove it, which nobody can. And again, I don't know precisely what happened, but I think that column speaks for itself, and I, too, have grave reservations about Ms. Broderick's claim. A very interesting piece of information, or I should say a very interesting allegation has surfaced concerning something that Clinton certainly did do, and that is his affair, such as it was, with Monica Lewinsky. I'm going to take up the following allegation at greater length when I review some aspects of the White House sex and/or alleged sex scandals. Those I have collectively termed Wankergate, and indeed 1998 was the year of the wanker, as I had termed it on my three-hour program originating from the Bay Area. I had long suspected a right-wing element of Mossad to have been utilizing the Clinton-Lewinsky affair. Indeed, Lewinsky's first attorney, Mr. Ginsburg, hinted that neither he nor Monica would do anything to hurt Bill Clinton because he had such a good record of friendship toward Israel. Then, after Newt Gingrich spoke to the Knesset and attempted to do an end run on Clinton's Mideast policy by endorsing the hardline stance of Benjamin Netanyahu with regard to the Oslo Accords, that was a hardline stance that Clinton repudiated, along with Hillary, who actually suggested that a Palestinian homeland would be desirable. All of a sudden, Monica Lewinsky cashed in her attorney and took on some hardline attorneys, including Plato Kasheris, who figured as a representative, or as a counsel, I should say, for Fawn Hall in the Iran-Contra affair. And Lewinsky herself took a much harder line toward Bill Clinton, and again, no pun intended with that choice of words. Our research credit on the following also goes to a member of the listening audience, and indeed there is an allegation of a Mossad connection to the Clinton-Lewinsky affair, albeit this one in relation to an alleged Mossad spy in the White House. The following article, again, tip of the hat to a listener, is from the New York Post, and it's specifically from the New York Post's website. This particular article does not have a date on it. Indeed, the New York Post is not the most rigorous of journalistic organs, and that's something of an understatement. This does, however, come from the New York Post's website, which is www.newyorkpost.com. And this was from the week of the first week of March. So check with the New York Post for the first week of March. This particular article was by Neil Travis, last name T-R-A-V-I-S. It was faxed to me by a listener who got it off of the Post's website. It's headlined, Israel Blackmailed Bill with Monica Tapes. It reads in part as follows. Israel blackmailed President Clinton with phone tap tapes of his steamy sex talks with Monica Lewinsky, a blockbuster new book charges. The price Clinton paid for the silence of the Mossad spy agency was calling off an FBI hunt for a top-level Israeli mole allegedly installed at the White House. The allegation appears in Gideon Spies, The Secret History of the Mossad, unquote, written by respected author Gordon Thomas and due out next week. Skipping down. Hints about the Mossad connection to Sexgate surfaced in evidence given to independent counsel Kenneth Starr last year. Lewinsky testified under oath that after a session of heavy petting and oral sex in the White House, Clinton told her that a foreign embassy was tapping the two phone lines in her D.C. apartment. She said Clinton advised her that if she was questioned about their phone sex sessions, she should claim that they knew their calls were bugged and were joking to make the phone tappers look silly. Starr did not pursue the matter as far as the public record shows, and Lewinsky apparently accepted Clinton's story without asking for details. But author Thomas says Danny Yatom, Y-A-T-O-M, Mossad Inspector General, succeeded in tapping Lewinsky's phone and amassed some 30 hours of sexually explicit conversations between the president and Lewinsky. Thomas says Tel Aviv used the tapes to stop the probe of an operative codenamed Mega, who was and could still be deep within the White House. After discussing the virtual impossibility of verifying these allegations, the article goes on to say, skipping down, it's been reported that the Justice Department and FBI launched an investigation last year for a suspected mole, codenamed Mega, based on undisclosed evidence that an Israeli spy had penetrated the White House. Israel heatedly denied a mole existed, saying it had ended such spying with the arrest of Jonathan Pollard more than a decade ago. Officials in Jerusalem said Mega was the codename for a U.S.-Israeli intelligence-sharing arrangement to fight terrorism. In any event, nothing has been heard of the U.S. pursuit of Mega in a year. The alleged Mossad connection adds a new dimension to Sexgate and could even support Hillary Clinton's charge that a vast right-wing conspiracy, unquote, was out to destroy her husband's presidency. Asked about that, Thomas replied, quote, that's not for me to say. I can only report the facts as I found them. When what you make of the facts is up to you. What Monica makes of them is up to her. And so, again, it remains to be seen what comes of this allegation. For background on some Israeli intelligence methodology and also their use of sensitive information as a source of leverage, I recommend a remarkable and vitally important book called The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, hard and soft cover editions by the St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. That book has not received the attention due it, probably because of the title. People saying, I don't want to read about Jews. In fact, it's about the interrelationship between international fascism, the petroleum industry, and the intelligence community, and it is a remarkable volume. Again, I have long suspected that there was a Mossad connection to the Lewinsky-Clinton brouhaha. And I do not know anything about the allegations concerning an Israeli mole in the White House, but I had observed the maneuvering of both Newt Gingrich and Benjamin Netanyahu with regard to Clinton's support for the Oslo Accords and his insistence that Israel adhere to the letter of those accords. And I suspected that perhaps Lewinsky was being manipulated by a right-wing element of Mossad. One should note, as I will take up at greater length in a future pair of For the Record segments, that Newt Gingrich himself had very, very strong connections to the Israeli right wing. in a pair of miscellaneous archive shows, one entitled Fascist Zionist Connections and the other entitled Strange Bedfellows, I have noted the connections between some elements of the Zionist movement and international fascism. Indeed, there are elements of the Zionist movement itself, a highly diverse and varied political movement, not the monolith it's sometimes portrayed as being, but there are elements of the Zionist movement that were explicitly fascist, including the Beitar, headed up by Vladimir Yabotinsky. Meir Kahane, the right-wing rabbi assassinated in 1991, was a member of the Beitar. So is Menachem Begin, a former Israeli prime minister. There was an even more right-wing or more fascistic element of the Zionist movement, the Stern Gang, that for a time advocated a military alliance between the Zionist movement and Nazi Germany to get the British out of Palestine. Its most notable graduate was Yitzhak Shamir, another Israeli prime minister. In connection with the Beitar, I discussed a connection in a pair of half-hour segments entitled A Look at Global Fascism. One of Vladimir Yabotinsky's closest supporters, his personal secretary and a pallbearer at his funeral, was Benzion Netanyahu, a professor emeritus of history at Princeton University, and the father of Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister of Israel. Benzion Netanyahu acts as a close political advisor for his son, and again one should note that Benzion Netanyahu, Benjamin's father, was the personal secretary to and a pallbearer for the casket of Vladimir Yabotinsky, the head of the Beitar. Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, came to power following the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, who had been a crusader for peace and a supporter of the Oslo Accords, and there are significant indications that the assassin of Yitzhak Rabin, Yigal Amir, was anything but a lone nut, and in fact was acting at the behest of a significant element of the Israeli national security and political establishments. That is the focal point of a new book that is reviewed in the Financial Times of London's weekend edition of February 20th and February 21st of 1999. That particular book is entitled Murder in the Name of God, The Plot to Kill Yitzhak Rabin by Michael Karpin, K-A-R-P-I-N, and Ina Friedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. It's published by Granta Books, G-R-A-N-T-A. This particular review is called Death in the Holy Land. It's by Isabel Hilton, and it's subtitled The Shocking Story of Why the Search for Peace in Israel Led to Murder. And skipping down in this story, Yigal Amir, the young man who pulled the trigger on the night of November 4, 1995, was no lone gunman. He was part of a mosaic of groups that had coalesced into a movement that campaigned against Yitzhak Rabin's government with a hatred that had never been seen in the country before. As Rabin tried to order the evacuation of the Hebron settlements in 1995, the fundamentalist rabbis fought back with religious rulings that declared it a sin to obey any order to evacuate. And skipping down about the Orthodox Jewish influence in the United States and Israel, Orthodox believers constitute only 10% of America's 6 million Jews and only 20% of the Israeli population, but they wield a political influence out of all proportion to their numbers. And skipping down again, the fact then that 70% of the American Jewish community supported the Oslo Accords was drowned out in the din made by its opponents, and Rabin himself, convinced that most American Jews supported him, paid little heed to his enemies. And skipping down again, of the assassination of Rabin, it is said here, it would be encouraging to believe that something was learned from Rabin's death, that the shock provided a catharsis in Israeli society and eventually a new unity of purpose. But it would be false. When Amir's girlfriend and co-conspirator was released, she was welcomed in her settlement as a heroine. The rabbis who had encouraged the conspiracy were not touched, and in religious schools all over Israel, children were told by their Orthodox teachers that Rabin had earned his death. Israel was revealed as a country that did not know itself, where secular Jews were shut out from the secrets of Orthodox society. By May 1996, when elections were called, Benjamin Netanyahu, who had been close to facing charges of complicity in the incitement to murder Rabin, became prime minister. The peace process remains stalled, as one of the Labor Party's intellectuals put it, quote, "We have learned nothing and forgotten nothing. We are in exactly the same place. This nation is not even capable of mourning together," unquote. So note that Benjamin Netanyahu himself had apparently been close to being indicted for incitement with regard to the assassination of Rabin. Moving on to subject material covered in the aforementioned pair of half-hour segments, a look at global fascism, in which the connection between Yabotinsky of the Beitar and Benzion Netanyahu and Benzion Netanyahu's connections to his son Benjamin were discussed. One of the subjects discussed at length in that program was the emergence of Russian fascism, and indeed I've discussed that in a couple of different half-hour segments. That was the focal point of an article in the New York Times of Tuesday, March 2nd of 1999. This is an article by Celestine Bohlen, B-O-H-L-E-N, dateline Moscow, March 1st, and headlined Russia's Stubborn Strains of Anti-Semitism. The article reads in part, "With their black uniforms and barely disguised swastikas, the followers of Alexander P. Barkashov's Russian National Unity Party are hard to miss, which is one reason their march in Moscow a few weeks ago attracted so much attention. The marchers, shouting out glory to Russia with stiff-armed salutes, numbered no more than 200, hardly a show of strength in a city of 10 million. But for Mr. Barkashov, 45, a ponytailed karate expert and veteran of an earlier extremist nationalist movement, just showing up was enough." And indeed, Mr. Barkashov's connections to elements of Russian officialdom were discussed in the aforementioned program called A Look at Global Fascism. Skipping down in this article, "How dangerous a threat is posed by Russia's neo-fascism is one of the main questions. It is not difficult to make a comparison between Russia today and pre-Hitler Germany, a collapsed economy, an electorate that feels bitter and betrayed, a weak central government. Poll takers do not have to look far to find a widespread yearning for a, quote, iron hand, unquote." And for further information, in addition to the pair of half-hour segments called A Look at Global Fascism, there's also a discussion of Russian fascism in a half-hour segment entitled Russian Fascism? Question mark. And there's a discussion of fascism in other parts of the former Soviet Union in a pair of half-hour segments entitled A Look at European Fascism, all of those available from Spitfire. Speaking of European fascism, an article in the Financial Times of London of Friday, March 5th of 1999, mentions a rise in the fortunes of Jörg Haider, the so-called yuppie fascist and one of the most successful of Europe's neo-fascists. His Freedom Party, it should be noted, was founded in the late 40s as a vehicle for the political rehabilitation of veterans of Hitler's Nazi Party in Austria. The following article is by Eric Frey, F-R-E-Y, in Vienna. It's headlined, "Haider Hopes to Gain in Regional Poll." Jörg Haider, leader of Austria's far-right Freedom Party, is poised for a political comeback this weekend when he is expected to make a strong showing in regional elections in his home state of Carinthia. Polls show Mr. Haider's party in first place for the first time, ahead of the Social Democratic Party, which has dominated Carinthian politics since the Second World War. Some surveys put his standing as high as 40%, up from 33% at the last elections. There's a discussion of Jörg Haider in a three-part series available from Spitfire. Haider compares himself to Newt Gingrich, a comparison I find apt under the circumstances, and he called his program a contract with Austria. More about Haider's contract with Austria. "A clear-cut victory would revive Mr. Haider's political fortunes, which have suffered from a string of scandals in his party. If the Freedom Party comes out ahead on Sunday, Mr. Haider will try to reclaim the governorship of Carinthia, which he lost in 1991 after praising the, quote, orderly employment policies, unquote, of Hitler's Germany." And some of the aforementioned For the Record segments and archive shows are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005, email spitfire@ix.netcom.com, a list of the Spitfire tapes at www.netcom.com/A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.